The lady who helped me. She gave me $2,000 that night. Said it was to help me get over it. Pine looked at the money. Jewel, that looks like a lot more than 2 grand.
It is.
Because you went back. Jewel started talking fast.
They told me they'd pay me every time. Pick me up and take me back. I'd be home before Mama would get off work. One time they even flew me on a helicopter to New York and we landed on top of the building. It was like, unbelievable.
And Jerome?
He didn't know. At first. But then he caught me coming back in one night. I tried to blow it off, but then he'd been asking around. He knew I suddenly had money. I bought some stuff. A ring and some earrings and a real Prada bag and a new iPhone and some cool clothes. I never let my mom see them. She would have been all over me. But Jerome found out. He got on my case about it big time.
And did you tell him the truth?
Some of it. He was real upset. Told me to stop going, and I did. I really did.
But after the first time, they didn't still drug you, did they?
No.
Was it the same man each time?
No. It was always different guys. But they all looked the same to me. Old white guys, but...
And what?
But once I did it with a woman. She was old too, maybe 40.
Pine said. Did you recognize her? Or the men?
No.
Did they talk to you? Asked Blum. Mention a name? Anything about themselves?
Jewel looked down and shook her head. I wasn't there for them to talk to. They just wanted me for one reason.
You're underage. That's statutory rape, said Pine.
They might not have known. Look at me. You think I'm 14?
Doesn't matter. That's why they call it statutory.
You really think they got Jerome to do what he did because of me?
I think it's a safe bet, yeah, said Pine.
And I'm the reason he's dead.
No, you're not. But you can help us find out who did it.
I've told you all I know.
No, you haven't. When did you stop going to that place?
They called the day before Jerome got killed.
Can I see your phone?
Why?
I want to run the number they called from.
I already checked. It's blocked. No number comes up.
When they called, what did they say?
That they weren't going to bring me anymore.
Did they say why?
No.
Can you tell us the address of the place in New York?
I don't remember.
Pine sat forward. How many times did you go there? Jewel shrugged.
Maybe a dozen. Maybe more.
And you don't remember the address?
I never paid attention. I was usually sleeping in the car.
Can you describe the area of town? What the building looked like? The street it was on?
Like I said, it was real, what you call high dollar. I mean, everything about that area was dope.
Jewel thought for a few moments.
But it was a number street.
Like 7th Avenue?
No, higher than that.
57th Street?
Yeah, that's it.
Was it near Central Park?
Yeah, that's right. I saw it one time when they were driving me back to Trenton.
Pine glanced at Blum and then pulled out her phone again. Would this be the building?
Jewel looked at the screen. Yeah, that's it. That's the one.
Pine looked at Blum again. Well, they don't just use that place for parties, then. A text came over her phone and she said, We have to go. But thank you for being so honest with us, Jewel. I know it wasn't easy for you. But what you told us will help us catch whoever killed your brother. She gave Jewel a card. Call me if you think of anything else. As they were leaving, CC Blake tried to ask them what was going on. Pine said simply, Keep an eye on your daughter, and have someone come over here to stay with her when you go to work at night. She jogged out to the car, and Blum followed as fast as she was able. What's up? Asked Blum, as Pine started the car and drove off fast. Puller's fully conscious and is out of post-op, and they're getting him a room. By the time we get back there, the attending physician will be able to brief us on his status. Chapter 48.
It was lucky that he's young and in tip-top condition,
said the doctor, a white-haired man with the calm manner of an airline pilot. They were in the visitor's room at the hospital. Robert Puller had been the one to alert Pine about his brother.
So you said he's fully awake?
Said Robert anxiously.
And doing well? He's on a lot of pain meds, so he's in and out. That bullet went clean through, but it hit some things along the way.
The surgeon mentioned that. Will he suffer any permanent damage? Asked Pine just as anxiously.
Well, it's too early to tell that yet. We'll need to do follow-up with tests, x-rays, and other imaging. But I can tell you that right now he's resting comfortably, and his condition is stable. When can we see him?
Asked Robert. The doctor studied him.
Your family, correct? His brother.
The doctor looked at Pine.
And your... His sister,
said Robert quickly. He turned to Blum.
And this is his Aunt Carol.
The doctor didn't appear to believe this, but gave a weak smile and said,
Okay.
He looked at his phone.
They just found him a room. I'll walk you down, but only for a few minutes.
When they got to the room, John Puller was lying on a bed with tubes and lines covering him. His eyes were open, and he looked over at them and waved with his good hand. Pine's gaze went directly to the monitor recording his vitals. They all looked reasonably okay, particularly for someone who had endured what Puller had.
You said the bullet had hit some things?
Said Robert in a low voice to the doctor.
Well, there's a lot around that region. Bone, blood vessels, ligaments. It could have been far worse if the bullet had pinged around in there. But the surgeon fixed it? Catherine is an excellent surgeon, and she did the best she could. But understand that this may not be the last surgery he has, though, and his rehab will be intense. I see,
said Robert, glancing nervously at Pine. Pine said, Well, he's going to come out the other end just fine. Probably better than he is now.
Hey, I can almost hear you,
said John Puller weakly.
So stop talking behind my back.
They drew closer, and the doctor said,
How are you feeling? How's the pain level? When can I get out of here?
Puller said firmly.
Well, that won't be for a while,
said the doctor, eyeing Pine with widened eyes.
I'm feeling okay,
said Puller.
I should be able to leave. I have work to do.
Robert said,
John, you just underwent major surgery. You need to give yourself time. I don't have a lot of time to waste, Bobby.
Pine touched his uninjured shoulder. John, we'll carry the ball while you're laid up here. All you need to focus on is getting better. Even Superman took days off. While Pine was speaking, the doctor had manipulated the flow of meds going into his system by punching in a new dosage on the controller next to the IV stand. The doctor then glanced at Puller, whose eyes fluttered and then closed.
I upped his pain meds to get him back to sleep. The last thing we need is for him to get agitated and pull at his lines or reopen the sutures. I think it's best we leave him to rest. You will be updated on his condition, and feel free to call in to the nurse's station during the interim.
He gripped Robert's arm.
Don't worry, he's in good hands.
Yes, I know. Thanks for everything.
As they were leaving the hospital, Pine said, His vitals were good, and the fact that he wants to get back to work is an excellent sign. Robert nodded.
Yeah, he's gonna make it. The only question is, in what condition?
You mean as a CID agent?
I mean as a member of the United States Army. It's his whole life, if he can't cut it physically anymore.
Let's not get ahead of ourselves, said Pine.
I saw your look back there. You were thinking the very same thing.
Pine changed the subject because he was exactly right. Where are you staying?
Near the hospital.
How long are you going to be in New York?
As long as it takes.
Later, Pine and Blum drove back to the condo, had a very late dinner, and went to their beds exhausted. After breakfast the following morning, Pine went back down to the street level and started to walk, her hands shoved deeply in her pockets and her heels striking the pavement with force. Shit, shit, shit. She knew that Puller had signed on for the risk when he joined CID. She knew that. She had done that when she suited up for the FBI. But still, she felt deep guilt for what had happened. Could she have eyeballed that alley more intently? If she had focused more, could she have seen the shooter or maybe sensed his presence? Puller had relied on her to clear the alley, and she had failed him. I failed John Puller, and now maybe he won't be the same John Puller. Utterly demoralized, she stopped and slumped down on a bench. Slapping her thigh, she sat up straighter, rubbed her face, and thought, okay, this sorry-for-me shit is not going to cut it. Start dissecting this case. What are the holes, and how do you plug them? Well, the holes were many. She was no closer to finding Tony Vincenzo, and thus just as far away from any information about his grandfather, Ito. Teddy was dead. Evie could be of no help. She had no leads on finding the man who had murdered Jerome, although now she did know about Jules' involvement and the uses to which that luxury apartment was being put. Only she didn't yet understand the motives behind it. And she doubted that Jewel was the only underage girl who had been recruited for whatever was going on there. And last but not least, the vile Lindsay Axelrod was out there somewhere. She was up to her slender neck in this, including the murder of Sheila Weathers. But what was the connection to Fort Dix? Tony Vincenzo and Axelrod both worked there, as did Weathers. If Weathers was involved only because Vincenzo had invited her to the penthouse, then that left Vincenzo and Axelrod. But what was so special about Fort Dix? The penthouse on 57th Street was definitely a clue, but she just wasn't sure how she could follow it up. She didn't have enough for a search warrant. But what about Jeff Sands? She pulled out her phone and scanned the news sites. There was nothing. The grandson of the Senate Majority Leader was violently gunned down in New York City more than a day before, and not one news outlet had reported it? How could that possibly be? Unless the NYPD was sitting on his ID for some reason. She figured if the Trenton cops could be co-opted, why not New York's finest, or at least some of them? She punched in a number and a few seconds later was transferred to the person she wanted at the bureau. Sandy, it's Atlee Pine. I know, it's been a long time, right? Look, could you do me a favor? There was a shooting victim the other night outside a diner in Brooklyn. The vic's name was Jeff Sands. He's the grandson of Peter Driscoll. Right, that Peter Driscoll. I haven't heard a thing about it in the press, and I was just wondering what the hell was going on. Okay. Yeah, whatever you can find out. Thanks. She clicked off. Sandy Wyatt was an agent in the New York field office. She and Pine had gone to Quantico together. They had been close and had kept in touch over the years, even though Pine had headed west while Wyatt had stayed on the East Coast. They were both members of WIFL, which was an acronym for Women in Federal Law Enforcement. To her credit, Wyatt had not asked about Pine's interest in the case. She would have afforded Wyatt the same courtesy if their positions had been reversed. Pine got up and started walking again. Her path carried her to the building on 57th Street. Billionaire's Row. Billionaire's Heavenly Perch, more like it. They lived far above the rest of us, thought Pine, behind doormen and concierges and trust funds and shell companies and the rules they created that gave them every possible advantage over everyone else. Getting on your soapbox is not going to help, Atlee. She stood across the street from the building when her attention was suddenly riveted. She quickly moved behind a parked truck and then peered around it to keep watching. The man who had shot Jerome Blake was coming out of the building. He was wearing a suit and tie and no cop's hat, but it was definitely him. He looked right and left, then headed down the street. Pine followed. Chapter 49.
Cheer up. I'm not dead yet, Bobby.
Robert Puller sat bolt upright in his chair where he'd been dozing. His brother was now staring at him from under the layer of tubes and lines.
You're supposed to be heavily sedated,
said Robert, drawing his chair nearer the bed.
Yesterday the doctor said he upped your meds. I have a higher tolerance than most.
Are you in pain? Again, higher tolerance. Do you know what happened to you?
Just a guess, but I think I got shot.
Robert smiled.
Okay, jokes are good. That means you're functioning at a high level. And Jeff Sands? He didn't make it. The shot that hit you killed him.
Robert leaned forward.
It was close, John. Another inch here or there. Don't you have an important job to do really far away from here, or is that just a rumor? Excuse me for caring.
Puller shifted a little bit in his bed. He stared at all the tubes and lines holding him down.
Why do I feel like Gulliver after he got jumped by the Lilliputians? Do you remember anything about what happened? We stepped out into the rear of the diner. Pine was in the lead. I had hold of Sands. I think I heard a pop, and that's pretty much it. They were obviously targeting him. They must have followed us from the nightclub where we picked Sands up.
Puller looked confused for a moment.
But the guys outside the club were a couple of thugs. I don't think they're involved in what happened to Sands. And who exactly do you think is involved?
Puller looked at his brother.
Well, since it looks like I'm going to be laid up here for a bit, you want to pitch in? Pitch in? As you said, I do have another job. Well, so long as you're here to hold my hand, it might take your mind off other things. I'm listening. You got me to Gloria Miles, and she led us to Jeff Sands pretty fast. Miles mentioned you found her through an algorithm.
Robert went over the algorithm he'd used, as he had already explained to Pine. Puller nodded thoughtfully.
I'll have to keep you in mind in future investigations. I have access to technology, databases, and computer networks that the average person doesn't, but I can't do that all the time. Not even for you, Junior. But you had to feed the algorithm to get anywhere. I just explained to you the factors I loaded in. I pinpointed certain political leadership and then degrees of separation vis-a-vis family members to see what would pop. Jeff Sands came up, and then it was pretty easy to trace the connection to Driscoll. Sands popped up because of his criminal background? As I'm sure you know, he's never been convicted, but he has been brought in and questioned a number of times. And he has certain business associates who do have criminal records, or at least questionable pasts. My data load factors covered those possibilities. But then his grandfather got the best lawyers involved, and nothing came of it. Apparently so. He told us he didn't know Tony Vincenzo. Did that name ever pop up in your digging? No, but I stopped pretty much after I got to Peter Driscoll. Then I looked for a connection to the military, and that's how I got to Gloria Miles. Do you think Driscoll knows his grandson is dead?
Asked Puller.
The Senate Majority Leader is not without his resources, and at the very least, efforts would have been made by NYPD to notify the next of kin. It would take them all of 10 seconds. Hell, his father lives right here in New York. Financial guy with lots of bucks. And a new wife and a brand new family. Not sure how much he'll mourn his eldest child.
The brothers gazed at each other, silently communicating something important to both. Puller said,
Yeah, if I had died, Dad wouldn't have even been able to process it. He doesn't know he has two sons. That's okay, Junior. We do. How soon can I get out of here? The doc didn't really answer me when I asked last time.
Robert didn't look surprised, but he said,
Not anytime soon. You are out of the game, John. Pine is carrying the torch now, just like she told you earlier. She can't do this by herself. And this wasn't even her case. She's working on something personal. She's only involved because she offered, and I accepted. Don't know what to tell you. From what I could see, the lady is firmly committed to this. And also, from what I've seen about the lady, I would not try to stop her. She's going to keep working this thing with no backup at all. That is not good, Bobby. John, I can hang around for a little bit, but I'm in uniform. I don't get to call my own shots. I thought computer geeks could work remotely. This computer geek needs a super secret SCIF to do his nerding,
replied Robert, referring to a sensitive compartmented information facility.
So I can't just hop on my Mac and get to it. Am I really stuck in this bed? They had me patched up and back in the fight in Afghanistan in no time, and those wounds were worse. In case you weren't aware, you actually have blood in those veins, and you lost a lot of it. Plus, the surgeon and the doctor said the round did some internal damage. They've got you so patched up you can't even move your left arm. You're immobile, and for a good reason. You're looking at a long rehab. To get fully back, you mean?
Robert dropped his gaze.
To just get better, John.
When he looked up, his brother was staring dead at him.
What are you not telling me?
Said Puller.
I've told you everything I know. You may make a full and complete recovery, but I may not. Can you predict the future? Because that gift somehow missed me. Good thing I shoot right-handed then. You're not going to be shooting anything for the foreseeable future. Seriously, little brother, if you want a decent chance at getting all the way back, you have to follow doctor's orders.
Puller looked away.
You said you stopped at Driscoll. What?
Puller glanced at his brother.
Driscoll was low-hanging fruit. I just wanted to find a contact to help you with the investigation. Can you do another search? Same sort of parameters and see what else you get? I'm not sure I understand. If Driscoll is involved in this in some way, what if he's just the tip of the iceberg?
Chapter 50. Pine shadowed the man and took his photo when he turned around across an intersection. Then he walked into an office building. A government building. A federal government building. Pine waited a few seconds and then stepped up to the door, peered through the glass, and then opened it. At the security checkpoint, she flashed her badge and creds to the officer there. She watched as the man got on the elevator and the doors closed. Excuse me, but the guy who just came through here and got on that elevator?
Yes, what about him?
Asked the officer, a woman in her 40s with short brown hair and a friendly expression.
I could have sworn he was an old friend of mine. Special Agent Simon King, used to operate out of Newark? No, that's Adam Gorman. Is he FBI? No, he's head of security for Congresswoman Nora Franklin. She's from an upstate district, but she has an office suite here she shares with some other politicos.
Franklin. I know that name. She's a pretty big deal, right? Said Pine. The woman smiled.
She's the ranking member on the House Ways and Means Committee. They write the checks, so yeah, a pretty big deal, all right.
Is she in her office today?
Yes, she came in about 20 minutes ago.
Well, Gorman is a twin for my buddy King. Sorry to trouble you.
No problem. You have a good day.
Pine turned and left. She walked halfway down the block and Googled Gorman. She found out he was born in Austria and had been a police officer and then a member of military intelligence there. He had immigrated to the United States when he was 29. He was now 48 and had earned a master's degree in political science from NYU. He had worked on political campaigns and briefly at a K Street lobbying operation in D.C. So a big deal congresswoman had a former Austrian intelligence officer turned security chief who one night had masqueraded as a Trenton cop and murdered Jerome Blake. And what do I do about that? It's really my word against his. John didn't get that good a look at him and is in a hospital bed. Jerome is dead and can't say. But I'm betting Adam Gorman was the guy who met with Jerome at school that day. And that means he knew all about Jewel and the encounters in the penthouse, a fact reinforced by the man's having just come out of the place. She looked at her phone. She had Gorman's photo and his image from her Google search. And the last time they had met, Peanut had given her his phone number. She texted him the article on Gorman, along with the photo and an accompanying message. Then she walked up and down the street, waiting for his reply. 15 minutes later, it popped up on her screen.
Yeah, that's the dude.
Okay, at least it was confirmed in her mind. But it was still not enough. Peanut would not carry any weight with a prosecutor against a respected man like Gorman. And Pine really had no hard proof that he was the man who had shot Jerome. Just a brief meeting in a dark alley under incredibly stressful conditions,
or so would say the defense attorney. She next Googled Nora Franklin. The face that popped up on the Wikipedia page was an attractive blonde woman in her mid-40s. She had an impressive resume. Born and raised in Colorado, she went to UVA undergrad and law school at Duke. Her father, at 73, was a long-serving and respected judge on the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. After law school, she had moved to New York City and worked for a small law firm specializing in employment law and representing mostly workers. Then she moved to upstate New York and then ran for city council. After that, she had run a congressional campaign and won on her first try. Since then, she had won 5 more terms in Congress and made a swift run up the ladder. Her being the ranking member on Ways and Means at a relatively young age had surprised some, the article said, but she had been a loyal foot soldier and impressed leadership with her skills and knowledge. If the House flipped in the next election, she was expected to become one of the youngest chairpersons of arguably the most powerful committee in Congress. She had traveled widely, the article said. She had married young, but it had ended in divorce. According to her official bio, she had practiced law only a few years. Pine checked an online database that listed the net worths of members of Congress. She was surprised that Franklin was listed as having a net worth of over $20 million. After practicing law for a short period, and in a field that was not known for huge payoffs for attorneys. So where the hell had that kind of money come from? Her phone buzzed. It was Sandy Wyatt from the Bureau. Hey, Atlee. I made some calls and checked some sources. As far as I can tell, NYPD has put a lid on this thing. I know they don't release Vic's names until the next of kin are notified, but they've surely had time to do that by now. Only thing I can figure is maybe Driscoll asked them to hold it for some reason. And for him, they probably would. Okay. Thanks, I owe you. Pine put her phone away and pondered what to do next. She could stake out the building and follow Gorman to wherever he went next, but she had no idea how long it would be before the man came out of the building. And she couldn't call in another FBI agent, because she wasn't technically working this case. And other agents had their own matters to pursue. But she had one asset to deploy. She pulled out her phone again. Carol, I need you. Within 30 minutes, Blum stepped out of a cab and walked over to her boss. Pine told her what she wanted her to do and showed her pictures of both Gorman and Franklin. Blum eyed the cafe behind them with a picture window and an unobstructed view of the building across the street. Then I'll just take up my position here. Where will you be? Fort Dix. As Pine climbed into a cab, she thought, what do I have to lose? When she got to Fort Dix, she would find out. Chapter 51. I don't understand, said Pine. How could that be possible? She was standing in front of Tom Whitaker, a JAG lawyer at Fort Dix. He was a short man in his 50s with rounded shoulders and a dour expression. He said in a pedantic tone,
it's like I just said, Bill Danforth and Phil Cassidy each took Article 15s. It's akin to a plea bargain in a civilian court.
Danforth and Cassidy were the two soldiers whom Tony Vincenzo had been working with on the drug distribution. Puller had arrested them both and had them confined in the stockade under guard of Army MPs. Pine thought they would still be there, but they weren't. I know what an Article 15 is. I want to know how it happened.
The concept is pretty straightforward, Agent Pine,
Whitaker said in a bored tone.
It was offered and they took it. Most court-martial trials end up in conviction. They knew that. Then the penalties are a lot worse and they have a criminal record. With Article 15, that doesn't happen. No criminal record. Just like civilian courts. Most cases in the military system don't actually go to trial. If every one of them did, we'd be clogged up for years.
Pine said impatiently. I know that too. I meant, why would they be offered a plea deal in the first place? My understanding was they were caught dead to rights by the CID. They were involved in drug dealing. How does that get them a slap on the wrist? These guys should have been tried, convicted, and sent to Leavenworth. The man shrugged.
That wasn't my call. The CO referred the charge, meaning it was going to trial. And I agree with you. The evidence was very strong. Had they gone to trial, they would have almost certainly been convicted. But then the Article 15 popped up and everything got thrown off the rails.
The Article 15 offer had to pop from somewhere, right?
Right.
So where did it pop from? Said Pine, trying to keep her voice calm, although she actually wanted to start yelling at the man.
From their CO. That's the only place it could have come from. He referred the charges, but then he offered the Article 15.
Why would he do that?
I don't know, and I had no reason to ask. I wear a uniform. I do what I'm told. When the CO talks, we listen. Pretty simple.
When did all this happen?
Late yesterday.
And who is the CO on this? Whitaker shuffled some papers on his desk and then looked at her curiously.
What exactly is your connection to this case again?
I was working it with CWO John Puller.
Yeah, you told me that. He was the one who collected the evidence.
For an overwhelming case that just got dropped, retorted Pine.
I heard he got shot in New York.
You heard right. Probably by the same gang that Danforth and Cassidy work for.
I wouldn't know anything about that. Is Puller going to be okay? All reports on him are that he's a first-rate soldier and investigator.
Right on both counts. And yeah, he's going to be fine. So the name of the CO? She took out her notebook and pen. Whitaker deliberately glanced at both and said,
I'm really not at liberty to tell you that.
Pine put her pad and pen away. Okay, what punishment did Cassidy and Danforth receive? Whitaker glanced at the paper in front of him.
Reduction in rank, lost some pay, and got 8 days confinement. But the CO suspended that for a year. They were in the stockade for a lot longer than that after they were arrested. He'll probably just let that ride.
So they just walk away with fewer dollars and the loss of a stripe? For being part of a major drug ring inside this facility?
I admit it's unusual.
You think? Where are Danforth and Cassidy now?
Back at the motor pool, as far as I know. I did hear some scuttlebutt that they've put in their discharge papers. Good riddance in my book.
This is a clusterfuck. You know that, right? Whitaker looked at her wearily.
Ma'am, I've been doing this job for 20 years. Nothing surprises me anymore.
Might be time for a new job.
What my wife keeps telling me.
If I were you, I'd listen to your wife. Do you at least have pictures of Danforth and Cassidy?
Yes, but why do you ask?
I'd like to see them.
Again, why? The case is over.
Not for me, it's not. Their photos? Please. It's really important.
You really think Puller getting shot was tied to these guys?
I think the connection is obvious. The man opened his desk drawer, pulled out a bulky case file, and spun it around. The mugshots of Danforth and Cassidy stared up at her.
Feel free to take their pictures.
Pine did so with her iPhone. Surprised you'd let me do that.
Ma'am, this is a clusterfuck. And in an ideal world, these two pricks should be doing hard time, courtesy of the United States Army. So if you can nail their sorry asses to the wall, it's fine by me.
Thanks, said Pine as she walked out. Chapter 52. Danforth and Cassidy were indeed in the motor pool, although, as Pine observed from a distance, they didn't appear to be getting much work done. Both were on their phones, texting. She didn't confront them there. She simply followed them when they left the base after their shift was over. They drove together to a military dive bar about 2 miles from Fort Dix. They went in and she followed. The pair had found a table in the fairly crowded place. The bar was called The Bunker. Unlike its name, The Bunker was large, open, and airy. Flags from all service branches hung over the walls. Helmets were mounted like trophy animals, along with ceremonial sabers, bayonets, and weaponry of all makes and sizes. Some couples in uniform were slow dancing in the middle of the room to jukebox music. All bar seats were occupied, with most of the patrons draped in army green. Pine was one of the few not in uniform. She eyed the pair and headed for their table after a waitress brought their long-neck beers. She sat down next to Danforth, glanced at him, and then eyed Cassidy. Danforth was big and beefy, and his expression was, to Pine, brainless. Cassidy was small and cagey-looking, and he shot suspicious looks at her.
Don't remember inviting you to our private party, sweet cheeks,
said Cassidy. Danforth let out an inane belly laugh. Pine shot him a look. You really thought that was funny? Danforth clamped his mouth shut and scowled at her. So, Article 15, huh? She said.
Who the hell are you, lady?
Snapped Cassidy while Danforth took a swig of his bud. An interested party. Did you know your buddy Jeff Sands got his head blown off in New York the other night? Both men gave a visceral reaction to this. Cassidy composed himself and said,
Don't know who that is.
Yeah, right. Like you don't know who Tony Vincenzo is, or Lindsay Axelrod. Did you wonder why Sheila Weathers didn't come back to work? She's dead, too. Also in New York. Danforth shot Cassidy a worried glance, but the latter shook his head.
We don't know what or who you're talking about.
Sure you do, Phil. And so does your buddy here, because he looks like he's about to crap his pants. Danforth grabbed Pine by the shoulder.
Look, you just need to shut up, it.
He stopped and looked at the badge she had just flashed him. Danforth slowly released his grip. Cassidy said,
You're FBI. You got no jurisdiction over us. We're soldiers.
I'll say this one time, dumbass. So long as you're in this country, I have every jurisdiction over you.
But we got the deal from the army. You can't touch us now. It's that double jeopardy thing.
He looked triumphantly at her. Double jeopardy doesn't apply between military and civilian prosecutions. The army cutting a deal with you has no impact on the FBI going after you. The only difference is you'll be spending your time at a max prison nowhere near here.
Shit, are you serious?
Google it, if that'll make you feel better.
Well, son of a bitch. That sucks,
added Danforth, pounding the table with his huge fist. She looked at their beers. If I were you, I'd drink up. What I'm about to tell you will go down better with a little buzz.
You're making no damn sense, lady,
said Cassidy, but he downed his beer, as did Danforth, who wiped his face with a meaty palm. When the empty bottles smacked the table, Pine leaned in and started speaking earnestly. The CID agent who nailed you?
Puller?
Yeah. He also was shot up in New York when Sands bought it. He just got out of surgery.
So, why should we care?
Said Cassidy, but he didn't look as confident as his words sounded. Do you know what Puller told me a few minutes before he got shot?
What?
This came from Danforth, who looked like he could use another beer. He said that he had to make sure you two were kept locked up and away from everybody.
Why's that?
Asked Danforth, sweat beads suddenly lining his wide forehead. Pine looked shrewdly at Cassidy. You want to answer your buddy? Because I think you know what I'm going to say.
You're saying he wanted us in the stockade for our protection?
Said Cassidy. She nodded.
That's bullshit,
barked Cassidy. Really? Let me ask you something. You two were caught dead to rights on drug dealing. I talked to the JAG. Ironclad case. No-brainer slam dunk. COs on your ass. You're both being court-martialed and sent to Leavenworth. Then, out of nowhere, you get an Article 15. The JAG said he'd never heard of such a thing. What do you think about that? Danforth eyed Cassidy.
Phil, you said it was because we got friends in high places. Shut the hell up, Billy,
barked Cassidy. He looked at Pine, who said, Or maybe you got the get-out-of-jail-free card because you have enemies in high places.
Are Jeff and Sheila really dead?
Then you do know them.
I asked you a question.
Pine took out her phone and scrolled through it. Here's an email I got from NYPD on Jeff Sands. She showed it to him. And here's another on Sheila. They're both dead. I saw their bodies. Cassidy read the emails and sat back looking worried. Danforth said,
What's this all about, Phil? What's she trying to say with all this crap?
Pine turned to him. What I'm trying to say is someone is cleaning house, and you two are on the to-do list. That's the only reason you got the Article 15 and a suspended sentence on your detention. So instead of being in the stockade surrounded by John Puller's hand-picked guards, you're out here as sitting ducks.
You're saying we got sprung so they could pop us?
This came from Cassidy, who had forehead sweat bubbles of his own now. You know Vincenzo's old man, Teddy?
No, but Tony told us about him. He squirreled away at Fort Dick's Pen on a long ride.
He was. Puller and I went to talk to him, all official and everything. Just as he was about to tell us something, they came and got him. No explanation, no nothing. Then before we knew it, he ended up dead in his cell. They say it was an overdose, though the guy wasn't a user. I'm thinking that they decided three prisoner deaths at the Fort Dix facility might arouse suspicion. So you two got set free, and you'll come to the end of your lives on the other side of the bars. You see it any other way? Cassidy hunched forward and spoke in a low voice.
Let's assume all you say is true. What can you do about it?
I'm FBI. I can protect you. But this is a quid pro quo situation. I need something in return. Otherwise, you're on your own.
Shit,
muttered Cassidy as he looked around the place.
Let's take this outside.
Pine rose. After you. Chapter 53. They ended up sitting in Pine's car. She said, First things first, where's Tony Vincenzo? Cassidy, who was sitting in the passenger seat, spread his hands.
Ain't seen him since we got arrested. Figured the locals would grab him when the CID arrested us, but that didn't happen. Least that I heard.
He was at his dad's house when I saw him last, where he had the pill operation, right? Cassidy shrugged.
If you say so.
The place used to be owned by Ito Vincenzo, Tony's grandfather. He ever mention him?
Once when we were over there and I was looking at some of the old photos in the basement. When I asked him, Tony said the guy just disappeared one day when he was just a kid. Said he didn't really remember him. Tony said his old man told him Ito was running from something.
Why would he say that?
I don't know. I didn't ask. I didn't care. But that's just what he said.
If Tony isn't at his old man's house, where else would he be? Cassidy and Danforth looked at each other. You guys know about the penthouse in New York? She didn't expect them to answer. Pine just wanted to see their expressions. Danforth grinned stupidly and said,
Awesome place. Shut up, Billy,
snapped his buddy.
You're gonna get us killed for sure.
Then you have been there. What's the deal? Axelrod said it was a perk. At least that's what Tony told her. Although, I don't believe anything she says.
Maybe.
Your answers are not adding up to a quid pro quo, gents. Maybe I should end this now and let you get killed before the sun sets. I don't like my time wasted with bullshit, so you can get out of my car. But run fast because they'll be coming for you.
Wait a minute,
exclaimed Cassidy.
Just hold on. I'm trying to process all this and it ain't easy. Just let me breathe, will ya? I mean, Jesus.
Okay, take all the time you need. Keeping in mind that patience is not my virtue. Cassidy chewed on a nail while Danforth slumped in the rear seat, looking like he might start crying.
Okay, look, we were working some drug deals.
But no drugs can get into Fort Dix. Lindsay Axelrod told me that. She probably regrets it now because it was probably the only true thing she ever told me. They have drug-sniffing dogs at all entrances. Cassidy grinned.
Yeah, but who said we were selling the drugs at Fort Dix?
He glanced at Danforth.
Right? We were at Fort Dix, but not the drugs or the customers.
Where were the customers then?
All around.
How did you get involved?
Through Tony. He needed some guys, and he knew we were handy and...
Didn't mind breaking the law? Cassidy shrugged but smiled. But again... Why Fort Dix?
Tony worked there, so there was that.
Who got him involved?
He told me once. His old man had a friend on the outside.
This old friend have a name?
Ricky or Johnny or something like that. Anyway, Teddy was in the can. He couldn't do nothing. But he got Ricky or Johnny to ring up Tony.
Nice of Dad to do that. So the Fort Dix connection is just because of Tony?
I guess so.
No, I'm not buying that. Because you're leaving out Lindsay Axelrod. She's been at Fort Dix longer than Tony. I checked. So why do I think Tony was feeding you a bunch of bullshit about his old man's friend, Ricky Johnny, and it was Axelrod who pulled him in? And then he needed a couple of guys and pulled you two in.
I guess it could have gone down that way.
What were your jobs with the drug ring? How did you two add value? Cassidy grinned, suddenly animated.
We drive army vehicles, from here to there, everywhere. Guess what happens when you drive army rides?
The cops don't stop and search your vehicles for drugs? Said Pine.
Bingo. We'd drive out of Fort Dix, take a slight detour, and the vehicle gets filled up with the stuff. They were pros. Took maybe 10 minutes at best. Then we continue on our way. Right before we get to where we're going, we're met by another team and get unloaded. Then we head on. Simple, right?
So you two never dealt with any customers?
No. Tony did the pills. But Axelrod was calling the shots. She's a computer girl. Can do anything with that shit.
Which also means she can move money digitally all over the world and leave no trail.
I seen her working one time. This was at her place. Her fingers flying over the damn keyboard. After she was done, she turns to me and says, "You know what you just saw?" And I said, "No, what?" She said, "You just saw $1 billion go down a rabbit hole."
Were Axelrod and Tony a thing?
They might have hooked up now and then. Tony is slick. He knows how to talk to the ladies. Lindsay liked him. She got him to perk at the penthouse. That's how we got to go.
So Tony is below her in the food chain. And who is Axelrod working for?
We never knew any of that.
Come on, Cassidy. Your deal is starting to fade to nothing.
Swear to God. Swear on my old granny's grave.
Pine eyed Danforth, who was looking at her and nodding. Okay, I guess I believe that. I mean, why would they let you two knuckleheads have that kind of leverage?
Leverage?
Said Cassidy.
What does that mean?
It means it proves my point. Okay, I really need to find Tony. Any thoughts on that? Cassidy shook his head, but Pine was watching Danforth in the rearview mirror. His expression was such that an idea might actually be forming in his very small brain. Yeah, said Pine expectantly.
Tony and me were drinking one night, and he mentioned a place.
What place?
His granddad's old place. It was on the Jersey Shore.
His granddad? You mean Ito?
I guess so. Tony said the dude made money selling ice cream.
That's the guy. Keep talking.
Anyway, Tony would go there sometimes.
You ever go with him?
Once. It was a nice little house on the beach. Really old, no AC, and they had space heaters. But then Tony had added one of them pellet stoves. Hell, they needed that in the winter because you could see outside through cracks in the wall. We sat on the sand and had beer and buckets of wings. It was sweet.
What was the name of the town?
I got it in my phone. I used my GPS to get there.
She had him text the address to her phone. Well, Jack Nicholson is from there, said Pine, reading a bit about Manasquan, New Jersey, which was located on the Atlantic Ocean. Went to high school there.
Cool,
said Cassidy.
He was the Joker in that old Batman movie, right?
Okay, I'm going to make a call, and you two are going into protective custody. You got that?
Hey, I just want to stay breathing,
said Cassidy. Don't we all? Replied Pine. Chapter 54. It was a little less than an hour's drive from Trenton to the borough of Manasquan, and it was dusk by the time Pine got there. Along the way, she had called Blum and told her what she'd found out, and also where she was headed. Neither Gorman nor Franklin have left the building, reported Blum. I've had far too much tea and coffee, but every time I went to the bathroom, I left my phone camera on video so I could see if either of them left. It was the best I could do. That was quick thinking, Carol. I think the folks who work at the cafe are either wondering if I'm suffering from dementia and don't know how to get home,
or thinking I'm interviewing for a job. Either way, just stay right where you are and call me if anything develops. And you be careful, Agent Pine. Driving through the quaint downtown, Pine saw it was full of small shops and restaurants. However, at this time of year, it was pretty well deserted, with many bars and restaurants closed for the season. But there were a few places open, and people were walking up and down the sidewalks while cars drifted past. Some parked, and people got out of them and went into several of the shops. It looked like any other sleepy beach town in the off-season. The smell of salt air lay thick over everything, like a compression shirt. She breathed it in and felt comforted somehow. She didn't get those smells in Arizona. Pine also spotted many large and elaborately constructed single-family homes on the beachfront. They looked fairly new and were undoubtedly expensive to build. But then again, it was oceanfront property, and they weren't making any more of that. She had loaded into her GPS the address Danforth had provided. She had taken both men to the RA in Trenton and explained what she wanted done. Neither of the agents on duty seemed inclined to take on this responsibility until Pine mentioned that they should call Clint Dobbs, head of the Phoenix field office, if they had doubts about helping. They told Pine that wouldn't be necessary and that they would see to the safety of the two soldiers, including contacting Fort Dix to let them know the men would not be back on base for the foreseeable future. As she neared her destination, Pine slowed her car and looked for a place to park. She found an empty lot that had beach access and pulled in there. The Atlantic spread out gray and foamy in front of her. The wind was chilly, the skies as pewter in color as the frothy ocean, which was broken only by the slash of white caps and the folding of breakers. She zipped her jacket up, looked around, and gained the lay of the land. Vincenzo's place was about 100 yards down the street, a small beach bungalow that looked nearly identical to the neighboring homes. She walked on and gained a sight line on the place from across the street. She drew a pair of small optics from her pocket, glanced around to see if anyone was observing her, and then took a good look at the bungalow. It was 1.5 stories, with dormer windows, saggy green shutters, a tan exterior, and no garage. Rotted and empty flower boxes clung to the underneath edge of the two windows bracketing the front door, which was painted black and badly weathered. A dark blue, rolling rubber trash can was outside by the front stoop. An empty six-pack of beer bottles sat next to it. A black exhaust pipe piercing the roof was a definite add-on, she figured, because it looked relatively new. Danforth had mentioned a pellet stove, and the pipe must be its exhaust source, she thought. There was a car in the concrete driveway that was spiderweb cracked in at least 5 places. The car was a Ford Focus with Jersey plates. As she kept looking it over, she spotted a Fort Dix parking sticker on the rear bumper. The yard in front was more sand than grass. She could have easily thrown a football from the backyard and hit the ocean at high tide. She recalled that there had been no car in Vincenzo's driveway back in Trenton, but the man had been there. Either this was his car, or he had gotten a ride with someone, or a person was visiting him, or he wasn't here, but whoever had driven this car here was. She found a cafe open across the street with a good sight line of her target. She ordered a coffee and a toasted bagel and watched the darkness thicken. No one came out of the house, and the car remained right where it was. She could hear the waves crashing on the beach as the tide rolled in. Normally a calming effect on people, it just made Pine more tense. 2 cups of coffee, a second bagel, and another hour of observation later, Pine took a moment to check her emails. Nothing from Robert Puller and nothing from Blum. She expected Puller to stay until his brother was clearly out of danger. No word from him was good, at least from Pine's perspective. And Gorman and Franklin must still be in the building. As a fog rolled in off the ocean, Pine's patience ran out. She left the shop, crossed the street, hit the beach, headed west, and came up on the sand side of the Vincenzo bungalow. There were no lights on in the house or in the residences on either side. There was a small, paved, fenced-in patio on which sat a set of rusty outdoor furniture and a tattered umbrella that was listing to one side. An empty beer can sat on top of one of the fence posts. Pine cleared this area and snuck up to the back of the house.
She peered in a window and found herself staring at what looked to be the kitchen. She tried the back door. Surprisingly, it was not locked. She pulled it open slowly, prepared to face loud squeaks from a seldom-used door, but it opened silently. She stole inside and took out her tack light, and the thin beam cut through the still darkness. She left the kitchen after seeing that there were stacks of dirty dishes and glasses in the sink. Apparently, someone, hopefully Vincenzo, had been here for a while. The air didn't feel musty either, which was another sign this place was being occupied, even if the car wasn't parked out in the driveway. After searching the house, she planned to check the car next when it was even darker. It was on the street side, which made it more perilous for her to search when people might still be walking down the street. Hopefully, it would be unlocked too. The registration would tell her who owned the car, and there might be some other things of interest inside. There was a small front room with decades-old furniture, a frayed carpet that looked ground down by sandy feet, and a small bookcase full of old paperbacks. The pellet stove Danforth had mentioned had been inserted inside the original fireplace. The black pipe went up into the ceiling and through the roof, as Pine had seen before. And as Danforth had said, she could see tiny cracks in the old walls where she could feel damp air coming in. This place must be hell in the winter, she thought. A small 5,000 BTU AC unit was perched in one window. A fairly new-looking Samsung widescreen TV hung on one wall, and there was an Xbox controller perched on the coffee table. Next to that was a virtual reality headset. That was a good sign that Vincenzo was in the neighborhood. And next to the VR headset, she struck gold. It was a photo ID card for Anthony Vincenzo, allowing him access to Fort Dix. There was one bedroom on this level. When she opened the door, it was like she had stepped back 40 years. The bed was made with a crocheted afghan on top, done in what could only be described as psychedelic colors. The bed and nightstands and bureau were all matching wood in a style from at least as far back as the 1970s. A tattered copy of Jacqueline Suzanne's Valley of the Dolls was on one nightstand, along with an old-fashioned wind-up alarm clock. The bathroom attached to it matched the age of the bedroom. The small closet was empty. She left the bedroom and approached the narrow staircase to the left of the front door. She ducked down as a car passed by outside. She cut off her light, stole to the window, and peered out. The car was already gone. The fog was thicker, and she could see no one passing by on foot. She clicked her light back on and took the stairs up. The half story must have been put on later, concluded Pine, because it was drywall instead of plaster, and the finishes looked more modern. There were two small bedrooms and a full bath up here, the latter with a one-piece fiberglass shower and double sinks. In one of the bedrooms, Pine found where Vincenzo was staying. A large duffel was on the floor, and clothes and remnants of fast food meals were strewn all over. The stink of stale French fries assailed her nostrils. She searched through the duffel and found a 9mm SIG. She popped the magazine, took out all the bullets, and cleared the breech before putting it back. If things went sideways later, old Tony would be reaching for a useless weapon. There was a smaller pink roller suitcase. She nudged it open. Inside were women's clothes, a box of tampons, and a fingernail file set in a small leather case. Inside the closet were about a half dozen women's outfits on hangers. On the floor were three pairs of women's shoes from heels to flats. Okay, he was shacking up with a girl. Pine wondered who that might be. On the nightstand was a bottle of OxyContin that, despite the label, didn't look to be prescription. Probably street-made with other shit in it, like fentanyl, that could send you to the hereafter faster than any other synthetic drug known. There was also a wad of cash bigger than her fist, and two burner phones. And a bong with a full baggie of weed sat next to the phones. Pine looked up and saw the dangling rope. She pulled on it, and a set of folding wooden stairs came down, revealing the attic access. She didn't expect Vincenzo to be hiding up there, but she wouldn't know until she checked. Still, she doubted he would have left his gun down here if he was up there. she mounted the steps and shone her light around. There was no floor, only ceiling joists with pink insulation in between. But as she kept shining her light around, she saw that some large pieces of plywood had been laid over some of the joists, and there were some cardboard boxes stacked there. The place smelled starkly of age, mold, and mildew, and Pine covered her mouth as she tread carefully over the joists to the boxes. Sitting on her haunches, she eyed the four boxes. She opened the first one and saw that it contained nothing but old, mildewed clothes. The next box was full of old photo albums. She quickly looked through them and saw a history of the Vincenzo family from the generation preceding Ido and his brother Bruno, all the way to Teddy's time. Evie had been pretty and vivacious. Ido looked reserved and disengaged. Bruno, decked out in a three-piece suit with a yellow pocket square in one photo, looked larger than life, his smile huge, his eyes bulging with delight, his burly arm around his brother, who looked like he would rather be hugged by a python. The next box contained business papers and copies of old tax returns from the ice creamery business. The contents of the last box stopped Pine dead in her tracks. Chapter 55. Robert Puller sat in the office behind a large desk with a computer screen that seemed even bigger. The building was a secure one. The room was windowless. The insides of the walls were coated with a material that would block exterior electronic surveillance, so it qualified as a SCIF. Access to the place was restricted by RF badges, with certain rooms, including this one, requiring retinal portals. Not many people could get into this building, and even fewer into this room. Robert Puller was obviously one of them. He had created algorithms, five of them, in fact, and unleashed them on all the databases at his disposal, which were some of the most exclusive ones in the world. He had also sent his search formulas like charging armies into every other database he could think of. He sipped on a Coke and let both the carbonation and the sugar wash over him. He had been at this for a while now. It was something he was used to doing, but not for the purposes for which he was now doing it. He stretched, stood, and did some light calisthenics. Though not yet 40, sometimes he felt twice that age. The pressure of his job, plus the countless hours bent over a computer, did not equate to a healthy posture. His phone buzzed and he frowned. It was his brother. He said,
"What the hell are you doing using your phone?"
"I promised the nurse to be off in under a minute, and she told me in no uncertain terms that she was coming to check, so talk fast. Anything yet?"
"If I had, I would have contacted you. Now turn the phone off and go to sleep."
"I got a text from Carol Blum a little while ago. She's watching a building right now."
"Why would she text you?"
"She said she wanted to keep me in the loop."
"Why is she watching the building?"
"Because our shooter is in there."
"Shooter?"
"The guy impersonating a cop who killed Jerome Blake. His real name is Adam Gorman. He's head of security for a congresswoman named Nora Franklin."
"Nora?"
"You know her?"
"Just in her official capacity. She's the ranking member on Ways and Means. I've testified before that committee."
"What's your call on her?"
"Smart, dedicated, committed, patriotic."
"Which begs the question of why she's got a murderer as head of security. Can you dig up what you can on Gorman? Pine apparently did a fast and dirty, but we need more."
"Okay, and where is Pine?"
"In her text, Carol said Pine's in Manasquan, New Jersey. She got a line on Tony Vincenzo and is running it down."
"Okay, I'll see what I can find while I'm waiting for my algorithms to do their thing. Now, your 60 seconds are up."
"I know. Nurse Ratchet just stormed into my room with duct tape."
The line went dead. Robert Puller turned back to his computer screen and typed in a search on Adam Gorman. He didn't expect to find much. The man would have been thoroughly vetted before landing a position with a congressperson. But background checks had been known to miss things, and the government had grown lax with doing them and allowed a backlog to accumulate. So maybe there was something useful that had slipped through. His first search brought up the basics: name, rank, and serial number. Puller did think it odd that the man had been a member of the intelligence services for another country before coming here. It was true that Austria wasn't exactly Russia, China, or Iran. It was a member of both the UN and the EU. A federal republic with a parliamentary-style government, Austria had proclaimed itself politically permanently neutral back in 1955. They obviously did not want a repeat of the Third Reich. However, a country wasn't a person, and who knew where Gorman's true allegiances lay? He did another search, read over the results, and then noticed something curious buried in the timeline background info on Gorman. He made a phone call to someone he knew in the State Department.
Hey, Don, it's Robert Puller. Yeah, it's been a while. Look, I've been doing some digging on something, and an issue popped up that I think you might be able to help me with.
Puller proceeded to tell him about Gorman and the possible issue he had found. His friend told Puller he would look into it and get back to him. Then, Puller turned his attention to the other person, Nora Franklin. Accessing both databases available to the public and those available only to a handful of people like him, Puller quickly accumulated what looked to be significant material. Taken alone, none of it added up to much. But when it was all put together, Puller sensed something that was important. He sensed a pattern. Later, his phone buzzed. It was his friend Don.
Got what you wanted. It was a 6-month period. Best as I can tell, Gorman went back to Austria for a sabbatical. Yeah, that's what I thought. But passport control records don't indicate that. Yeah, I know,
said Don.
That puzzled me too. And the airline he flew on after he got overseas was curious as well.
Right, it's a sub of Aeroflot. Is this something we should focus on?
Puller said.
I'll let you know the answer to that as soon as I can.
He clicked off and went back to the search on Franklin. He was looking at two things, financial disclosures and travel, going back 15 years. The financial disclosure forms required by the government were, to his mind, a joke. Everything could be placed into ranges, 1 million to 50 million. Assets could be hidden behind shell companies or in relatives' names to avoid having to disclose. There were a million different dodges, and Puller had found that the politicians with the most money and assets worked very hard to hide their wealth. For electability reasons, they would much prefer to have the image of just being ordinary folks working for a living. What he found with Franklin was a mountain of diversions and inconsistencies. He marveled at the fact that no one had called out the woman on this before. Then, the truth struck him. Why would her colleagues call her out when many of them were probably doing the very same thing? When he looked at the timeline of her history and travel, something seemed to click in the back of his mind. That's when he digitally laid Gorman's timeline over Franklin's. There was only one time period that matched. A 6-month sabbatical that both had taken at the same time. Only Franklin had not flown on a sub of Aeroflot. But she had ended up in Austria, and from there she could have gone anywhere by car or train or private jet, and Puller would have no accurate way to track that. The other thing that stuck out for him was the fact that shortly after Franklin returned to the States, she started her first bid for elected office. She had now won re-election multiple times and had a lofty perch on Ways and Means and other committees, including, tellingly for Puller, the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, meaning she was privy to most of the important intel secrets of this country. A feeling of dread rising up in him, he placed all this in a file and emailed it to Pine. Then he sat back in his chair and wondered what else he could do to help. A phone call he got a few minutes later answered that question for him. Chapter 56. Pine held up the pair of pajamas as a whirlwind of memories engulfed her. They were small, the size for a tall 6-year-old, as Mercy had been. They had pink ponies on them. They were the PJs that Mercy had worn the night she vanished. Pine had a matching pair that their mother had bought them, although Pine's were not pink but blue. She held the cloth up to her nose, hoping that it retained her sister's scent. After all these years, there was none. It was just mildewed and smelled foul. She picked up the packet of